We will now move to agenda item 3, fire protection. This is an informational item. It's our fire season update, and Doug Graff will present.
Good morning, Chair Anderson, members of the board, State Forest Authority. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection for the Department of Forestry. I was unable to join you at the last meeting. September 9th was relatively busy at that moment. And at that time, would not have been in the position now to breathe a little bit and share really the salient points from my perspective coming out of this fire season, where I'm going to focus on the media and all Oregonians involved in this fire season. I feel like I don't need to recap in detail the process from beginning to end, but I think there's some key elements for the board to hear today based on the experience we lived. Salient points for me, I'll speak with presentation on COVID and our engagement there. Fire season, just a general summary, State Forest Authority provided much of those details. Feel good there. The ACA data points will be important. I'll linger on finances. Finances will be, I think, critical as we think about moving forward. I want to look at where we're at with past fire seasons and some thoughts moving forward to the exposure we have now. A little bit of highlighting on our resource availability. And then I close with putting this fire season in context relative to our past and where we want to move forward, guided by the governor's wildfire council work. And we have a half hour to do that, and I will share my screen and we'll follow presentation. Stand by. And a validation, please. Is my screen before you?
Not for me.
Not yet.
How are we doing now?
Yeah, I think it's coming. It says we're viewing your screen. It's just a white blank page at this point.
Make another run at this. There we go. I think I got the right one. Thanks for your patience.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see it now, Doug.
Thank you very much. Okay, so the first point I really wanted to make, and you heard Brett Weidemiller during this fire season, which is protection supervisor out of Coos Bay, and he guided our COVID response. And outstanding report at that time, and I would just leave the board closing out the COVID conversation. Fire season is very successful from my perspective. We had a significant challenge before us, and that is how do we deliver fire protection across the state in a time of COVID? The first step was put a committee together, build the guidelines and the planning modules on how we're going to provide for the health and safety of firefighters. We established COVID modules, which is three-person teams that were deployed to each of our incidents to perform the screening, testing, isolation, and quarantine protocols that were adopted. And then we added capacity with investment from the legislature, $2 million to provide us with the personal protective equipment necessary in our emergency response functions, and the capacity to hire health professionals to connect us with the local health authorities to ensure that when we came into counties with our incident management teams, that we were communicating on a daily basis and understood the testing capacity and isolation and risk at that county and ensure our plans were aligned. This is a bright spot for what has been proven to be a very difficult year, 2020, with COVID plus the fire seasons. And I really equate to this front end, the subcommittee, the planning, with Oregon State Fire Marshal, local fire service, Oregon Health Authority, that really guided this effort. And at the end of the day, we did experience six positive COVID cases. We had a number of isolations and quarantines and testings performed. And when you think of 7,500 firefighters deployed at one time during this fire season. I look at that as a successful plan implemented, and many thanks to those who followed suit and guided this effort. As I think about fire season going into 2020 and frankly where we're at now, I think this map really highlights a lot of things relative to what we faced October 27th, 2020, and you see this extreme drought condition still today. This has expanded throughout the fire season, and what it has driven is really the foundation of what we will experience in fire risk in the state. Drought plays a significant role. It continues to really keep an end of fire season at bay. In three of our districts, we still remain in fire season because the indices suggest we need to be there. And in Southwest Oregon in particular, our indices were showing extreme this past weekend, and we ran on at least five fires over the weekend just in that district alone. We're anticipating moisture at the tail end of this week. We should see those three districts move out of fire season. And I would highlight that Southwest Oregon started in May, May 1st in fire season. So May, June, July, August, September, October, and into November. Certainly one of the longest fire seasons that we've experienced in the Southwest across the state. And drought is a major factor on this. I'll speak a little bit more to this as we close and we think about perspective relative to what we're facing in our future. As we reflect on September 7th weather event, which kicked off the Labor Day fires, it's really an alignment of forces. First, this visual brings you from the morning of the 7th through the afternoon. You can see we have a couple fires on the landscape right now. And this is the Lion's Head and Beachy fire that we're burning. As you start the day, this cold front moves from northeast to southwest, and you'll see what it does when it hits these two fires. That's a dry cold front, which brings erratic winds on the front end of that. That cold front was followed by a 72-hour period of steady east winds. As State Forester Doherty highlighted, 20 to 30 mile an hour sustained winds, gusts averaging in the 50 to 60, but in extreme conditions, you know, we saw gusts over 100 miles an hour in some of these drainages on mountain peaks. Which ultimately resulted in what we've experienced as one of the most destructive natural disasters here in Oregon's modern history, the Labor Day fires of 2020. The drought conditions play a significant role because the third alignment of forces, first the cold front and then the east wind event, we were seeing at that time historically dry conditions on the landscape. We've been measuring energy release components, which is an indicator of fire risk on a daily basis for the past 30 years. And we have peaked at this time, particularly in Southwest Oregon, had peaked new record highs relative to our fire risk at that time. So truly an alignment of forces. If you look at the next series of days, you'd see really that steady east wind. And I think we all remember the smoke, you know, covering much of the state following that steady east wind. And the briefing paper map here highlights our result. Immediately following that those frontal winds and over the course of the next 72 hours, 17 significant fires across Oregon's landscape. State Forester Doherty highlighted, you know, overall to date over 1.2 million acres burned from these just 17 fires alone drove about a million acres of that statewide burn number. Over 4,500 structures lost, and to date, and I'll detail more of the finances, over $130 million in large fire costs to the state of Oregon. And that's specifically through ODS protection somehow, which we'll detail here in a moment. Complex condition on the landscape, all Oregonians full attention in response and supporting each other. As State Forest Authority highlighted some heroic events in this dramatic fire season. What this means to ODF protected lands, the 16 million acres, this slide provides some context relative to our statistics on acres burned. ODF has protection responsibility on the 16 million acres, and our 10-year average year to date is we expect in the range of 930 fires that we respond to on our protection. And our 10-year average is 41,000 acres burned. You can see where we sit in 2020. You know, the numbers of fires are pretty steady with what we would expect. But obviously, given that event, 541,000 acres burned on ODF protected land. We have not seen that in our history. And I'll close with a historic slide here that gives context of what that really means relative to our over 100 years of fire protection. And the challenge, of course, with those acres burned drops that target of 98% of fires 10 acres or less. We're sitting at 94% currently on our target of 98% of acres held at 10 acres or less. And what that equates to relative to cost, greatest number of acres burned in our history. No surprise relative to cost, but I'm going to linger a little bit with the board today on the finances. Speak first to this fire season, and then we'll look back where we stand in the future. And I wanted to make a few key points as we look at facing $133.9 million in large fire costs on ODF protected lands. 2013 marked our highest exposure in our history, and we surpassed that in 2020. I often reference our net costs to the state because this is our gross costs. It includes our FEMA recoveries, which is in the range of $64 million to be expected, and includes other agency billings where we are engaged across property lines and will bill other agencies once we settle our cost shares this spring. The net cost sits just under $50 million, and that's a key number as that's the trigger point for our Lloyd's of London insurance policy. So at this time, I think perhaps one of the most surprising responses I get from folks when asked about finances, they fully expect that we'll be into that policy. We're teetering on the edge of that, just below the trigger point for the insurance policy. And the main driver for that is the late entry, if you will, September 7th and fire season to that weather event. If that happened early August, certainly would have eclipsed these numbers with cost exposure. And the second main factor, of course, is the FEMA recoveries are significant. We established a major disaster declaration, and that supported $64 million of recoveries. I think the other key element to highlight in our finances, we've obviously been challenged with processing the cost of fire seasons in the past and carrying the debt associated with that until those recoveries come in. And I've spent a fair bit of detail with the board on that matter. And we'll, the next slide, we'll look back again and give you stats of where we're at. My sense here, looking at $133 million, is given the work that we've done over the years and implemented new strategies starting in 2018, we continue to be committed to processing these dollars in the time frame we've established, a 2 to 4 year period for all recoveries. I fully expect to close out all the cost shares that we have with our other agency partners this spring. It will be difficult to bring actual costs to the table, I believe, from federal partners. The process is not totally conducive to that. There are payments that come in later, such as the large tanker costs that come in. But they're going to work really hard, and they're considering adding the capacity necessary to be at the table with us in the spring. And we'll need to do that in order to get the collections we need through FEMA and other agency billings to settle those. So at this point, the plan remains the same. And we have the limited duration and temporary capacity in our finance ranks that we've had for several years to help process these. And my plan is to continue on that mode and deliver as this board and others have expected to return those receivables. I think relative to cash flow, that is interesting to note also this year. And I'll pause after I state this, see if there's any questions on the finances before we go back into previous years. And that is, now we're not the paying agent on a lot of these fires, meaning the fires started on federal land. So original orders come through the federal dispatch centers and through our master agreement. That means that agency pays for the initial costs of those fires for all those procured resources. So we're not carrying the debt like we had in 2018, 2017, where you look at those numbers, we had to carry that cost and then recover all the dollars. This year will be a little bit different. We don't have to carry $133 million in debt. We're closer to, I think, in the range of $70 million to start with. And we will be receiving billings from our federal partners once we settle our cost shares. And we can develop a strategy in coordination with FEMA to not pay those, align the payment of those bills with us receiving FEMA recoveries, so then the state is not carrying the debt that we have had to in the past from previous fire seasons. Still, that $70 million we do not have in hand that we do need to put out up front. And that's what's triggered initially our treasury loan, which we have secured entering into this fire season. So there's a lot there on the costs. I'll linger here for a moment if there are any questions.
Any questions before about this aspect of Doug's report? Looks like you can keep going, Doug. Thanks.
Okay. So where do we stand from previous fire seasons? And this slide is a summary. You see this in your monthly report that you're added to with the Ways and Means. And relative to where we've been in the past with over $100 million outstanding receivables, you can see from 15 to 19, we still have work to do. We have invoiced $26 million. That means that's sitting in FEMA's hands or other agency billings. And we have $13 million left of work to do. Broken that out on what is invoiced. How much is in FEMA's hands? How much is in other agency billings? And you can see that detailed here. Where FEMA has some money to turn around for us for a total of $26 million. And then this is parceled out in terms of how much work we have left to do and with who. The FEMA claims are the final step in the process for recoveries. And you can see where we're coming out of the tunnel, if you will. If you're looking at 15 and 16 and in particular, we should get some quick turnarounds on those years with some final billings and cleanup. 17 and 18 shouldn't be too far behind. And then we'll be sitting, I think, into early next year with 2019 and 2020 fire season ahead of us. And our target is to clean this outstanding workload and put it behind us. And with the new system established in 2018, I think we've got a good process and plan in place to continue that progress. So move on to the statistics relative to safety, first and foremost in my mind, in my position, and to ensure the health and safety of firefighters in response. And we continue to see, you know, a steady trend. I'd love to see this go down, but generally speaking, we're in that range, consistent with past. As you look at this across per 200,000 hours worked for FY 2020. So that ends July 1, FY 2020. These are always a little bit behind relative to our annual statistics. In my next slide, I'll highlight what our current fiscal looks like as we entered into this fire season. 2020, you know, in that range of total hours worked in the claim, so pretty steady in terms of solid safety record. As we look at the fire season proper, June, July, August, September months, compelling, of course, is we can see that increase in hours worked on fires, particularly in September. So that's where a large majority of our staff completely shifted over to supporting the firefight. And
we are we're cutting out a little bit there. Is that, do other board members have the same problem? Nope, it's just me then. Keep going.
Okay, I'll lean in a little bit more. And you can see six injuries in September, even though, you know, 21 times the number of exposure hours relative to on fires. And that's really what we want to see, minimum injuries, even with this greater exposure. That tells me an awful lot around that we're putting primary mission, health and safety, first and foremost. So proud of the work to date, and we'll report out on this as we do annually when we finish up this fiscal year. But wanted to give you the early months and indications where we stand on this fire season. As I think about resource availability, I would highlight the severity program continues to be effective. And critically important is this is really about initial attack. The severity program, which is mainly aviation assets, fast moving mobile equipment, but we also move ground resources in advance of lightning storms, wind events, to keep that one next large fire off the landscape. Incredibly effective, 1,500 hours flown this year, aviation assets. And you can see the distribution of where those are at across the helicopters, detection, single engine air tankers. And I'll linger on the large air tanker because it's important to the conversation today. This is the last year of our tanker program as it exists today. We've been using this company and this program, large tanker, for a 10-year span. They've been outstanding, been owned by a couple Oregon companies through our relationship, have served Oregon well. We're retiring this aircraft from our contracts and interested in moving towards a next generation program if we can make that investment through the legislature. But critically important at this time to recognize limited dollars, increase in costs on an annual basis, and no change in that cost, that severity, available dollars. This is the resource, given it's our 10-year agreement is up, that we're moving on, and we're very much interested if we can get a signal towards an investment consistent with what's requested in the Governor's Council to continue to tank a program. Been excellent work, and for those on the Alameda fire, they certainly saw this running out of Phoenix, and talent played a critical role in holding those lines, those flanks, when that fire made its run. But a long storied history with the large tanker program. So really proud of the work we've done with these companies, Oregon companies, over the years. So nice work there. I've also highlighted several times With this board, an investment from landowners through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund into the PATNAVIA, which is our multi-mission aircraft. We flew over 100 hours this season, mostly at night, but we had daytime missions specific to mapping needs on ongoing fires. Primary mission was gathering intel on existing fires through the night, and keeping an eye out for new fires. We spotted 10 new fires over those 100 hours flight time, and those get dispatched in the evening. And a particular one of interest is in Klamath, 3.5 acres. The schoolhouse fire was burning undetected. By daylight, you know, that fire is lined and contained with those lines and crews on it by daylight. This is the power of these night shifts. Great investment. We're going to continue to see tremendous dividends. This is augmented with other infrared technologies through the military assets that we've engaged with and local contractors. So we deploy these across Oregon for much of the fire season to gather greater intel so we can make good fire management decisions. As I reflect on this fire season, and I think about the 1,500 miles of line that was put in close to a two-week period, it brings to bear some of the unique aspects of Oregon's protection system, and that's no doubt. I just highlighted investments from landowners through the strategic investments for the PATNAVIA aircraft, but the resource availability that's brought to bear in Oregon, because this is a system that expects landowners to participate in the firefight, and there is absolute dedication with that and commitment, both on the financial front, but on the operational side. These are folks we train with every spring, and we had over 350 pieces of equipment locally available through landowner operator resources, and 650 individuals to lead and support that equipment. And that type of arrangement you will not find in any other state, and it would have been impossible for us to establish those control lines within the short time that we did after the Labor Day fires. So just a huge shout out to the volunteers there in the Southeast. That's our Rangeland Fire Protective Association members, and then, you know, landowner operators on the left side. The heartbeat of this state's response starts at the ground level with participation of all landowners, and really proud to serve with those folks. Contracting community in Oregon is absolutely outstanding. Also, the aviation assets we're able to bring to bear and the ground resources are tremendous. So we're fortunate to be able to have this much fire on the landscape in that short a time and deliver what we did in terms of suppression activity. But where do we go from here? We certainly are facing challenges. This is energy release component trend. I referenced it earlier. It's one of our key indicators of our risk on a daily basis as we go into fire season. And back in the mid-90s, we had critical thresholds exceeded for energy release components on about 20 days within the fire season, 3% of our days. And now you can see we're closer to 33% of our days where we're exceeding critical energy release components. So that means more fire risk ahead of us as that if that trend continues. And all the climate modeling that we look at suggests that is absolutely the direction we're heading. What does this mean relative to the context of history? I included this map. I'm not going to linger on this today, and we could spend a day chewing through this, but I just want to draw attention and leave this as a placeholder for you all as you want to dive in any deeper. The acres, which is the orange bass, which is the drought years, and the yellow acres burned non-drought years. We have not experienced this type of fire acres burn on ODF protected lands in our history. We exceeded the big years, the Tillamook burns. 1933 was the first one. In the range of 340,000 acres, we're sitting at 541 by a couple hundred thousand acres on ODF protected lands. And you can see the trend line and numbers of fires in the heavy white line. It's been relatively steady, but I'd certainly like to drive that down, as the majority of fires are human caused in the state of Oregon. And then the 10-year trend line, which is the dark red one, acres burned, shows that increasing trend from 2013 at an alarming rate. So where do we go from here? And I anchor tightly into the Governor's Wildfire Council. We've been obviously fully engaged there, and that's anchored into the cohesive strategy, which is adequate protection, fire adapted communities, and resilient landscapes. What's key in that conversation is a recognition that capacity relative to ODF personnel. We're operating in the same place we've done in the past decades. So we certainly are interested in advancing a program commensurate with the risk we face for Oregon, and that's critically important. In the response to mitigation, it's fully recognized there's a structural challenge for carrying that debt. Even on a year where we are not the paying agent for many of those fires, we still have a significant amount of debt to carry that triggers that insurance. That triggered the loan, I'm sorry, from Treasury. And mitigation policies, both at the resilient landscape and the wildland-urban interface, very key. All those recommendations embodied in the work of the Governor's Council. And I'll stop short there with recovery, as State Forester Daugherty really highlighted much of that work and the critical work there that's going to come to this agency and is already in our private forest program and state forest program, who is certainly impacted. With that, I would close and thank you for your time. Clearly a tremendous fire season to live through. I would not want to have done this in any other place. Oregon is now my home, not originally, as it was clear in many of those briefings. But folks, we have a tremendous system and a tremendous organization to build from. Proud to serve you all and all Oregonians in this capacity. I could not have done it without the leadership around us. And looking forward to where we go from here. That would be the end of the report. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Doug, for the report and also for all of your efforts. Really extraordinary this season. Are there any questions for Doug at this point? Looks like we can let you go. Thank you again.
Hey, Tom, there's four of us raised our hand.
Oh, geez. Somehow I'm not getting those. I apologize. So go ahead, Nils, and then I'll get to the others.
All right. Jim, I know you raised your hand first, but I'll follow the chairs. Doug, thank you for this, comprehensive and thorough report. I'm curious, coming towards the end of your presentation, looking at fire season severity and the ERC trends, trying to get a little better understanding of how thorough the data is on that and to what degree. You referenced there that fuel loading, woody fuel moistures and larger fuel moistures influence the ERC. And, curious if we know, what are there elements of that that are driving the trend up more than others, or are all three of them moving in the same direction, and how much variation is there between east and west, or northeast and southeast and southwest Oregon in that, that would allow us to, you know, think strategically about how we respond to that trend. You know, what are the appropriate actions to respond to that? And then to get your thoughts on that, because, you know, we're not, obviously we can't just continue to invest in more and more suppression with these sorts of trends. We got to figure out how to get ahead of this.
Thank you, Nils. Absolutely. We can dive as tight as we want on that. That's 30 years of data built from our districts. So we have that at a district level. So what I showed was an accumulation of all districts combined relative to that trend. We can see certain districts, particularly Southwest and Eastern Oregon, that are driving that trend more so than Northwest. So we can go there. It's really a climate driven trend, because it is those fuel conditions. Energy release component is a result, is an indicator of the energy at a firing front, which is driven by live and dead fuel moistures. So, you know, drought conditions and those climate trends really drive that ERC. I think I'll leave it at that. There was a lot there, sir, but I think, okay.
You're muted, Tom.
Yeah, I see that. I now see the hands raised, and I'll just go through the order in which I have them. So, Jim Kelly, you're next up. Thanks.
Okay, great. Doug, the first thing that I would want to say is just huge congratulations on what you guys did in terms of COVID. I think, you know, there was a lot in the media about the threat and the fact that you guys accomplished what you got accomplished is just unbelievable. And I think all Oregonians would want to congratulate you guys on that. But what I wanted to ask you about is, I mean, we as policymakers, we're now all facing after the Labor Day fires, all the stakeholders with their viewpoints about what should be done. And of course, the legislature is going to be facing pressures and decisions as well. And as I look at it, the Labor Day fires, I'm concerned that we, if we lump the Labor Day fires and that kind of circumstance together with other fires that we have more commonly dealt with, it's kind of like, you know, lumping Western Oregon Forest and Eastern Oregon Forest together, you know, that obviously have such different fire ecology. How important do you think it is, Doug, that we maybe create some different language for the kind of circumstance that we witness with the Labor Day fires? I mean, I know we all hope that we will never see such an event again, but I think we all know due to climate change that it's very possible that we will see more similar events in the, you know, relative near future, that being in the next couple of decades. And I worry as policymakers that if we don't really differentiate, I mean, the things that we need, in my view, the things that we need probably to do relative to dealing with both fighting large fires and community protection are pretty different than what we probably should be doing for the more typical kind of fires. What are your thoughts on all of that?
Thank you for that question, Jim. There's definitely a component of that we have to be careful, because we have had 500,000 acre fires on the landscape in our history. And we have good records of those back into the 1700s. Fire is a part of this landscape and will always be part of this landscape. With that said, I think the Governor's Wildfire Council took a broad perspective of all Oregonians and a historical perspective of where we've come from and a perspective of the best modeling we have relative to any climate trends and what that does to fire risk. And as I look within this state and around, particularly California, Colorado, the trend of which fire season risk has increased in my tenure has surprised me. I worked in California when they're in the second decade of droughts. Towards the first tail, the first tail end of the first decade. When I moved to Oregon, drought conditions were initiated in 2012, and we're coming to the tail end of our first decade of drought. I think we need to balance the reality that those fires are on, you know, in a natural part of the landscape with the reality that there is absolutely an increasing trend across the nation from a fire season to a fire year. California's conditions continue through this winter. And I thought the council had a very balanced approach to doing that. And I would echo Nils's response that simply investing in suppression is not the answer, cannot be the answer. But we must align suppression capacity with the reality of increased activity across the landscape. And we need to think about those policies that are laid out in the council's work, in the particular, the mitigation, which gives me the greatest opportunity to be successful in my fire suppression task, minimizing acres. That's how we can manage that landscape, both in the wildland-urban interface and across the landscape in its entirety. So, yes, I think being cautious, Jim, to look at 2020 and not overreact, but it's certainly an indicator, a stronger indicator of the trend that's been reinforced over the last decade or so, particularly in Oregon.
Okay, thank you. And the next one I have here is Brenda.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And thanks, Doug, for that really great overview. But especially thanks to you and your staff and all of your colleagues for protecting human life and property during these events. I mean, it really is, we owe you a debt of gratitude. So I wanted to preface what I'm going to ask with that, because I don't want to have what I'm going to ask to in any way minimize those comments. You all have done an amazing job. But two questions. One is, to what degree are the ecological benefits of fires being incorporated into the forest recovery efforts? And the other is, are we accounting for the greenhouse gas emissions associated with fire protection, fire suppression, and forest recovery?
I'll speak to the first one, and State Forest Authority has been closest to the greenhouse gas analytics and may have a comment there. But on the ecological benefits, this board addressed over the last 3 years the reality that fire is on our landscape and how we can leverage it, if you will, with prescribed burning. And I think you've set us up apart from much of the West relative to setting a tone and an expectation that fire will be a part of the landscape. It is one of the greatest tools we have to mitigate that risk on the landscape. And up until COVID, given additional smoke in the air, we certainly were doing our part in the state of Oregon with prescribed burning and advancing that. I'm very much interested in seeing, you know, that continue into our future. So the ecological benefits of fire certainly acknowledged. Also, as those lands are treated and we can reduce the risk of, say, a wilderness fire moving off of that landscape, Certainly we'll be able to realize more and more of those ecological benefits that are provided by fire on the landscape without putting life and property and values at risk. Relative to the greenhouse gases, I don't have an answer to that question.
Yeah. Thanks, Doug. My reason for the asking ecological benefits question were comments that you made and comments that Nils made about stocking levels and the fact that fires like this have always been a part of these landscapes. And these mixed severity fires do have benefits to a wide variety of ecosystem services. So thanks for that. I'm glad to hear that that's being considered.
And I will add on, you'll be hearing about the forest ecosystem carbon report again at this meeting. And around 300 of those plots that are the basis of that report are in the fire footprints. And so it provides a pretty unique opportunity. That's a large number of plots to look at beginning to get some real data across all forest pools on the effects of fires and fires across these fire footprints. And we've been contacted by a PNW researcher that's very much interested in doing that. We don't have the financial capacity right now to support that. It would be a great study, though, and we're trying to see where we can get cooperative funding to get that done. And I think you do raise a really interesting question, the relationship between carbon mixed severity fires and the pattern of the landscape that existed prior to the suppression of fire on a long-term scale. So the right now, if you think about the west side of the Cascades, it's almost continuously forest canopy. And historically, there was a lot more open areas than areas where you would say they were, from a forestry point of view, they were traditionally understocked, even on the west side, and very much open with just relics of forest patches on them. And so I think there's a lot of work and thought about how do you begin to restore that diversity at a landscape scale to minimize the risk of, or the effects of events like we had with this east wind event. So yeah. I think there's a lot of work and there will be discussions about moving forward. We're starting that already around how do we want to restore to better prepare?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. That did not answer my question, though. The question I asked Doug was, there are fossil fuel emissions, greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels associated with forest protection, forest suppression, and forest recovery. And my question is, are those fossil fuel emissions associated with forest protection, suppression, and recovery being accounted for?
Thank you. I'm sorry if I didn't clearly understand your question.
Yep. And so, again, I guess not.
I will respond. You will not like the answer. They are being accounted for. They're not being accounted as distinct from other consumptions of fossil fuels.
Thank you.
Okay. Next. Joe Justice.
Thanks, Tom. I just really just have a comment. Doug, thank you so much for the work that you've done and your staff. And I know how hard it is on your staff in these long fire seasons and just the amount of time away from family, what they see out there, the devastation they see. I've worked alongside so much of your staff over the years. And I can't say enough about the culture that ODF has working with landowners. It's incredible how all of that works together. And that's not easy to maintain that culture and to maintain that. And I couldn't agree more that is one of the huge reasons why we can have success in firefighting in Oregon and why Oregon is so unique. So, but I, you know, fortunately, Northeast, you know, we dodged some bullets in Northeast. We got very, very, you know, nervous in Northeast when things were going on and things were, and resources were stretched so thin. But as I, you know, I talk to staff that come through Northeast and I talk to them that going back to fires and the commitment of your staff to Oregon is just tremendous. So thank you very much, Doug. Thanks.
And Cindy.
Yeah, thank you. Doug, as always, we've come to expect you gave us a very good presentation and a wonderful summary of sort of where we stand across the whole gamut of issues associated with this. I'd like to link back a little bit to some of the comments that Jim made earlier. Both we and legislature and sort of policymakers statewide and nationally are trying to figure out how to respond to this. I'm wondering the extent to which your division is involved in evaluating the way the fires played out on the landscape from an ecological perspective and from a fire behavior perspective, particularly during the Labor Day events, which really, you know, were almost classically driven by the kinds of abnormal weather conditions that we anticipate are going to become more common as climate change continues to impact the way the world operates. And, you know, if that's going to increasingly be the kind of situation that we're going to operate under, it seems to me that it's really, really important to evaluate what kinds of forest management prior to the Labor Day was effective or not effective in impacting the way fire behaved on the landscape. And so I'm wondering, you know, to what extent are you involved in what I'm sure must be a fair number of efforts looking to correlate that information?
Thank you, Cindy. Yeah, relative to the fire behavior, I mean, that absolutely is our business. In order to understand, you know, how to respond to fires, you got to understand fire behavior. And that's 101 for any firefighter. And we will continue to engage. OSU does a lot of work on that front. And we're closely engaged with OSU when they look at this work and have done so for some time. But relative to response, I would highlight the cohesive strategy has provided this nation with a framework to speak to this issue and guide us moving forward. And Oregon's leadership at that time evolving the cohesive strategy was significant. And we engaged from county commissioner level to fire manager level and influenced that framework. And that has led to a roadmap for us and where we want to be to respond to an increasing complexity of fire on the landscape. And that's the Governor's Wildfire Council recommendations. So I feel really good about where Oregon's position and thinking is relative to moving forward, because we do have those plans in front of us. So I know there'll be more time to discuss that. It's primary in fire protections, Board of Forestry work plan. It is my number one effort with you all on all those fronts, and we'll continue to remain engaged across the board on those topics.
Sort of an anecdotal level, because I know it's way too early to have actually completed any, you know, valid scientific analysis of it. Were there areas where, because of some of the either prescribed burn or whatever other kind of forest management had previously occurred on the landscape, were there areas where you were surprised by the fire behavior that you were having to deal with, or were there areas where you sort of said, ah, yes, we expected this kind of management to make it a little easier under rough conditions. Did you find any of that sort of stuff going on? At an anecdotal level, I won't hold you to scientific standard at this point.
Thank you for the emphasizing the anecdotal. That type of fire behavior is scary, period. And we've seen that, you know, in all of our careers as fire managers, firefighters, at some way, shape, or form, those 300-foot flame lengths in front of you coming out of that heavy timber, we have significant fuel. But it's always the key driver in this conversation relative to fire behavior is wind. Topography and then fuel conditions come after that. So we can only manipulate that outcome of fire behavior so much when you're faced with the driving factor of wind. Fuels management, which we call mitigation or resilient landscapes, absolutely plays a critical role. We're not going to change anything relative to slope. that exists and is also a key factor. Anecdotally, no surprises relative to 60-mile-an-hour wind with that much fire on the sea, what that's going to do. And, I'll leave it at that.
Cindy, okay. I will add, I didn't have time to really talk about it, but there is a group stood up, and Liz Dent is leading that effort to coordinate on research and monitoring opportunity in the burn areas. And so you're right, it's the pattern, as you might expect or guess, is not uniform in terms of burn severity across the landscape, but I wouldn't want to speculate at any time how that was related to forest management versus other factors. I think it'll take some time to figure that out.
Okay, thank you again, Doug.